You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 282, Cookie Monster. Oh my, will Donald Trump steal Christmas? I've done most of my shopping and picked my tree up. The reinforced glass ceiling and why women don't call in to sports shows. Punk's not dead. We review Slaves on Tour. That's all coming up after Jesus Jones, right here, right now.
Watching the world wake up from history. Number two on the Billboard Hot 100, only number 31 on the UK Top 40, but a hit all around the world in 1991. Jesus Jones, right here, right now. Welcome to podcast episode 282 from the Parish Council. We look into a kaleidoscope of politics, life, sport, media, everything. My name is Terence Stackham, and providing the sparkly colours in that kaleidoscope is Juliet Harris.
That's me. Red and yellow and pink and green, purple and orange and blue. Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone.
Jules, in matters arising, last week we spoke about the annual festival of breastbeating that takes place largely in the media, about whether people should or should not, may or may not, choose to wear a poppy to show that one is remembering those who've been victims of conflict since the First World War. However, you've discovered this week that this yearly turmoil of whether or not to wear the poppy has now engulfed Sesame Street.
It has, yes. And I think this story is possibly my favourite story of the entire year, in that it makes me howl with laughter and want to scream in equal measures. And actually, most other news stories at the moment just make me want to scream. So at least we've got the howling laughter element. So there's so much about this to unpack for a relatively trivial story. So some listeners might be familiar with the work of The One Show, which for people particularly that don't live over here, it's a sort of a magazine show that takes place five nights a week, so Monday to Friday, every weeknight on BBC One at what we call prime time over here, I would think, so 7 o'clock. So often I'm watching it whilst I'm eating my tea at my parents' house or whatever. It's very much that kind of thing. It's quite a light show, has a male and female presenter, and they have two or three guests on during the half an hour usually, and they talk about sort of, you know, usually it's people that have got stuff to plug, by and large. This occasion, I think it was Tuesday or Wednesday of this week, they bring people on, and of course, because it's a BBC programme, they bring the guests in. So they've got Chris Tarrant, who I'm not an enormous fan of anyway, I must say, but he was on, and the Cookie Monster from Sesame Street, the large blue furry cookie enthusiast, was on as a guest, which in itself is a bit bizarre. Apparently, I think he was on Today or so, PM or something as well, on Radio 4. He's sort of plugging something to do with Sesame Street. So this puppet, is over here. And the fact that he was a guest on The One Show, I found slightly curious anyway. But, of course, because it is Remembrance Week, or has been Remembrance Week, the presenters were wearing poppies, sort of the cardboard ones pinned on, and Chris Tarrant was wearing a cardboard one pinned on, and the Cookie Monster was also wearing a poppy. There is so much to unpack with this, mostly because I said to a friend of mine the other night, I know we both complain about how stressful our jobs are. I know we both have to make ridiculous decisions every day, and there is pressure. Just thank the Lord that neither of us will ever be in a, neither of us are currently in a position where we have to sit in an editorial meeting at the BBC and decide whether or not a puppet from Sesame Street should be wearing a Remembrance Day poppy and whether that affords enough respect. Ironically, to me, it smacked off the BBC thinking, oh, God, we'll get criticised in the right-wing press. Oh, no, we have to show respect. And then you sent me a link to the Daily Mail story, absolutely doing their nut, to use the technical term, at the fact that the Cookie Monster was wearing a poppy, which they found to be immensely disrespectful. You see, now, I thought it was idiotic that, you know, why on earth have you gotten to this? Why have we driven the BBC to this hysterical state where they feel that they have to put a poppy on a puppet of the Cookie Monster in order to make, you know, in order to avoid controversy, which they haven't succeeded in anyway, so maybe there's a lesson there. Arguments in sort of favour of this ridiculous decision. A chap tweeted at me and said, but part of the core of puppet making and being a puppet master is to imbue the puppet with as much human experience as possible, apparently, so maybe that's why. Also, a colleague of mine at work, somewhat less philosophically, said to me, I think it's only right and proper that the Cookie Monster should wear a poppy. And I said, it's a puppet. And she went, he's a guest on The One Show. It's more than I've ever done in my life. So, the Cookie Monster wearing a poppy, the crazy world in which the BBC finds itself, or has put itself, one could argue either way. Yeah, the Cookie Monster wore a poppy. It's what the dead in Flanders would have wanted, etc.
How unusual that you should be sharing a sofa of philosophy with the Daily Mail. But
I know yes, indeed. Although, having said that, I'm not sharing a sofa of philosophy in the sense that I think it's ridiculous that the Daily Mail is one of the, I suspect, one of the largest considerations why the BBC had to get involved in this ridiculous decision making process in the first place.
My main concern with this is this question. Did they fix the poppy on with tape or did they use a pin? Because the poor Cookie Monster has only got blue fur.
Yeah, he's not wearing clothes.
Yeah, so if it was a pin, well, I think we'd need to alert the authorities. I'm not sure which authorities, because, you know, in terms of cruelty of sticking a pin in the Cookie Monster.
I think he's a full age, so I don't think the NSPCC are the people to go to.
It's difficult to know where to go with this.
Well, doesn't that sum this story up?
it's where I have some sympathy with the political correctness gone mad people, as you say. Now, it may not have escaped your notice, but just in case everybody else has been sidetracked by, I don't know, some political event across the Atlantic. I don't know. It's 42 days until Christmas as we record this podcast, which means it's time in the UK for businesses to start reminding us in every television commercial break that it is Christmas is approaching. Incidentally, they're far more sensible in America, waiting until Thanksgiving and, you know, this is so-called Black Friday is over before they focus on Christmas. But here in the UK, Tesco are already using TV commercials to flog mince pies. And now we have this, in inverted commas, tradition of one of the biggest stories being the launch of the John Lewis Christmas television commercial. And with all of the hullabaloo and the fanfare, you'd be forgiven for believing this. These commercials have been around since the dawn of television. But the first one was in 2007, yes. 9 years. Now, I find these new traditions cumbersome and clunky, but I'm wondering, am I just an old curmudgeon, Jules?
Well, if you are, then I stand with you, brother, frankly. I find this completely tedious as well, particularly as, and I think this is, my problem with this is summed up by this story that sort of broke beforehand. So the John Lewis, I mean, all of the other stores you might note are now starting to kind of copy as well, but John Lewis is still seen as the kind of, to use the completely appropriate phrase, market leader in this respect. There was a student, an A-level student, who made a fake John Lewis advert. So he did about a minute and 25 seconds of something. It's called Nick Jablonka, and he made this for his media A-level, and it's a sort of a cutesy kind of, you know, emotional Christmas advert with an acoustic cover over the top, and it was about a minute or so long, and it went viral. And has had more than 375,000 views, and it had only been up for a day or two. And he said, "Oh, it was very rushed. You know, it's not great." But having said that, it showed to me that and it said here that his work was beating some of the genuine Christmas ads, and that it at this point in time, this story was taken from last Sunday. The House of Fraser version that has music by Lauren Vula had fewer than a third as many views on YouTube as this chap's film, and it just goes to show that actually this John Lewis advert masquerades as every year as being, you know, this great emotional kind of release and showing the true meaning of Christmas, and actually this chap's this is not to knock this chap at all, but the fact that an 18-year-old A-level student can knock one out that people think is the real thing, the fact that anyone can do it suggests to me that perhaps it's not that authentic, really, and perhaps it is ultimately just flogging stuff. But if anyone wants a good view on this, and I will try and send Terence a link so he can tweet it out. Anna Leskowitz, who writes for the New Statesman, she wrote a piece about the John Lewis ad, and it was far more sarcastic than her usual style is, and it is worth it because I think it completely bangs on. And she says, I'll try and read it a little bit of it because I just think it's so entertaining. She says, In my day, Christmas wasn't just about shiny garden furniture. The John Lewis advert features a trampoline prominently, by the way. It was about huddling around evergreen plants and the warmth of small fires whilst gorging on meat in order to survive the long, harsh winter. We didn't buy each other handbags and trainers. In my day, we walked 20 miles in the snow just to get our shoes. In my day, a Christmas present was about expressing love for your families who may not endure the darkest days of the year. I remember when the John Lewis Christmas advert wasn't about selling John Lewis products. far from it, my friends. Hark back with me to 2010 when a mournful Billy Joel cover showed us that a brand and a person can share in a lifelong commitment as sacred and unconditional as a marriage, the one condition being that the person continues to buy fridges and Charles toys from the brand. And it very much continues in that vein. And you know, it's very... I find it, I mean, I get caught in this bind because I think it's tedious and rather sad that you know, our the idea of Christmas hasn't started until the blessed Coca-Cola lorry turning up locally. I mean, people take time off work to go and see the Coca-Cola.
Oh, they don't.
I've worked with people that have gone, I'm going to leave early tonight because I'm taking my niece to see the Coca-Cola truck. You know, there's that. And there's also the kind of the idea that, you know, Christmas hasn't started until John Lewis advert is on and this and that. And I find that pretty repulsive. But then equally, I then think, you know, if other people, that's how they want to celebrate, do I need to be as judgy as I am? I don't know. But I personally find it difficult. I can understand why people, when you work everyday life in and day out, why people might take pleasure in such things. But I don't know. I'm not feeling the John Lewis love. And I'm so disappointed because John Lewis are probably the most progressive of all the department stores, and that they're still owners of cooperative. And I find that sits particularly weirdly with me, that it's them that have kind of gone into this sort of, you know, rampant capitalist sort of trudge thing, really.
At this time of year, I do feel very sorry each year for Mr. John Lewis, an American professor from Blacksburg, yes. Virginia, you know, who has the Twitter name of @JohnLewis, and so each year he receives a sort of selection box of tweets, some cheery, many abusive, as people use Twitter to give feedback on the new commercial, all of them not realizing that the store has the Twitter name @JohnLewisRetail. So, but Mr. Lewis of Virginia, he's turned his annual responses into a humorous form of art.
Yeah, that's
true. And he has endless degrees of patience. So
absolutely. Much like that young lady that had the Twitter name The Ashes, who was then ended up, having originally got quite angry about the fact she was not a cricket match, by the end, there was then a large crowdsourced campaign to send her to watch The Ashes, I think. She got quite into it and became quite friendly with Jonathan Agnew, I think, as a result.
Excellent.
So yes, well done, everyone.
Now, Jules, I've been on this planet for long enough, quite a long time, to have been... I think
we've heard enough of you, Sir Terry.
Exactly. I was a tiny child during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and then after that we had the assassination of two Kennedys, Watergate, the Cold War, Bill and Monica. So I kind of reached the conclusion that everything settles down and the world keeps on turning, but I know that you've been very affected by the result of the election of the new president in the USA this week.
I have, yes. President Donald Trump, and how are those words we ever thought we'd say? Has been elected in America. It's been a strange week, hasn't it, really? It's been extremely depressing. I suspect that, you know, our listeners have heard an awful lot about this, but I thought that, you know, it would be nice to have our perspective on it as well. Interesting, today, we're recording this on Sunday, the 13th of November,
yeah.
And at this point in time, there are still votes to be counted in California, and it looks like Hillary Clinton will probably win the popular vote, who's a Democrat candidate. She'll win the popular vote by probably about 1.5%, they reckon, which that total would give her more than the votes received by any other presidential candidate in history, except for Mr. Obama in 2008 and 2012. And yet, because of the electoral college system, here we are, and Donald Trump has been elected. There's been endless analysis as to why that was. We hear a lot about, we've talked previously on the podcast about the Rust Belt and sort of the white working class vote. Having said that, you know, there were very affluent people that voted to Trump as well. I think that the white theme transcended economic themes. I do think there was a worrying swing towards white supremacy with this. I know a third of Latino voters voted for Mr. Trump, but that meant that two-thirds didn't, and the Afro-American vote was still enormously in favour of Mrs. Clinton. I think a lot of those of us that think of ourselves as being quote unquote progressive are, you know, this is Brexit, the sequel, isn't it, really? This is Brexit plus, 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 as President Trump's elect Trump summed it up. It feels like a very strange time. It feels like a very dark time. It feels like we're possibly stood on the precipice of history repeating, I suppose, really. It feels, you know, the 20s and the 30s and the 40s were economic depression, followed by the response to economic depression, a nationalistic response, followed by a world war. So I really do hope that history doesn't repeat in that sense. But I suppose, you know, one has to grieve something before one can then move on and begin to understand it. But I'm going to pick this tune to play now because I think it sums up to me how a lot of us feel about how the America that we thought we knew is sort of lost at the moment. But, you know, if we want to move on from this, we've got to try and find a way of looking for it. So this is Simon Garfunkel, and this is America.
Cigarettes and Mrs. Wagner pies, and walked off to look for a man. said as we boarded a Greyhound in Pittsburgh. Michigan seems like a dream to me now. It took me 4 days to hitchhike from Saginaw. I've come to look for America. Laughing on the bus, playing games with the faces. She said the man in the gabardine suit was a spy. I said be careful, his bow tie is really a camera. Toss me a cigarette, I think there's one in my raincoat. Smoked the last one an hour ago. So I looked at the scenery. She read her magazine, and the moon rose over an open field. Kathy, I'm lost, I said, though I knew she was sleeping. I'm empty and aching and I don't know why. Counting the cars on the New Jersey Turnpike, they've all come to look for a man.
Laughing on the bus, playing games with the faces. She said the man in the gabardine suit was a spy. Though these days, he's more likely to be a pollster from Nate Silver's 538 polling website. Yeah. Yes. You know, who's going to ask you which way you're going to vote before publishing an entirely incorrect forecast of the election results.
I have to say, Nate Silver got it closer than a lot of people did. I know that we could talk about the failure of the pollsters generally, but, you know, he gave Trump more of a chance than anyone else did.
Mm. Well, somewhat amazingly, that was only number 25 in the UK.
Yet another proof that the general public are not to be trusted with anything, one suspects.
Well, an astonishing only number 97 on the Billboard Hot 100.
Well, like I say, the American public especially.
From the winter of 1972, Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel, America. Now, here's some names. Jackie Oakley, Gabby Logan, Lindsay Hipgrave, Helen Chamberlain, and of course Claire Balding. Very familiar names and faces. Women presenters of sport who have broken through that so-called glass ceiling to end the long-running male dominance in sports presentation. However, anyone watching Sky, BT or BBC's Match of the Day over here in the UK would notice that while some women are now asking the questions, there are no women appearing as the experts with the answers. And I was thinking, if television can employ inarticulate experts, such as Robbie Savage and Glenn Hoddle, might there not be room for, I don't know, say that the former England football player Rachel Yankee or current Chelsea striker Eniola Aluko, that glass ceiling in those terms, Jules, seems to be fairly locked down.
It does, doesn't it, really? Although, having said that, Amy Lawrence sometimes appears, who's the Guardian's football writer, one of them, sometimes appears on that lunchtime Match of the Day thing on Sundays. I've seen her on that before. So there are... But then, having said that, she's very much the exception rather than the wall. Yeah, I agree. It's very peculiar that gradually, you've got people like Jackie Oakley and breaking into commentary and then into sort of presenting an analysis. I associate her a lot with women's football, which is getting more and more coverage on the BBC. But isn't it strange that I remember what, you know, I've watched women's football on the BBC for years and years and years. They used to do the FA Cup final every year, and then gradually as it becomes more popular, they've shown internationals and things like that. And they have a weekly sort of show now about it. But it used to be the case that they used to have male experts talking. So Gavin Peacock was quite a big supporter of women's football. To be fair to him, he was a big supporter. He used to go on and you know, to talk about it and have knowledge. But isn't it strange how it's easier to get male, or it's more, they seem to be more inclined to find male experts talk about women's football. That's all right. Yet women talking about men's football is less all right. And
exactly,
I find that very strange.
Yeah, that's my point.
That's very peculiar. So you know, and I think, I mean, I have to say, I find Amy Lawrence's contributions to be quite useful. And but one thing that actually, and maybe this is the nature of my Guardian, it's kind of analysis, they tend to employ writers who are, I think, sometimes fairly open in the fact that they support certain teams. So Daniel Taylor and Jamie Jackson are Manchester United supporters, and Amy Lawrence is an Arsenal supporter. And as a result of which, I think we've talked about this in the past before, they can give a perspective on those teams because they presumably have connections, because they have sympathies, they might have better connections, I don't know. A part of me thinks, oh, I wonder if Amy Lawrence gets slagged off for being an Arsenal fan in the comments, in the grimness that is the below the line of the Guardian comments pond. I wonder if she gets more of a criticism than Jamie Jackson and Daniel Taylor for being Manchester United fans. No, they seem to get equal slaggings, apparently, so that's all right, isn't it?
Reassuring, yeah.
Equality in that context.
Yes. One of the broadcasting success stories of the last couple of years has been the rise in audience figures of the UK radio station Talk Sport.
Also known as Radio Wind-Up to some people.
Well, in many ways, it is more listenable than ever, with a clever mix of presenters. You know, you've got Jim White, who has been a revelation since coming over from Sky Sports.
I find him very interesting.
Very, very funny, articulate.
I agree that Talk Sport is a very different animal to what it once was.
It really is. I think anybody who sort of thinks, oh yeah, you know, I know what it's going to be like. It's changed substantially. Hawksby and Jacobs, Mike Parry, Mike Graham, and they've got some witty regular guests, including Bob Mills, Stuart Pearce. But you may be ahead of me here. They're all men. They do allow Georgie Bingham, who's undoubtedly a woman, in to present the breakfast show on weekends. Otherwise, it seems to be men only. And this is reflected in the listenership. 2016 figures show that TalkSport's percentage of male listeners is an extraordinarily whopping 84%. Ooh. And I notice that this is reflected by their callers. It's so rare to hear a woman ring in with an opinion on a sporting topic that the presenter almost faints and makes a point of emphasising that it's Emma from Basildon, you know, or let's welcome Julie from Newcastle. You know, now, do you think women feel intimidated to call in? I mean, would you worry that your view wouldn't be treated as valid and you might be patronised? I don't know. How would you feel?
Yeah, I do feel a little bit like that, I must admit. I mean, I have to say, and this isn't aimed at TalkSport at all. This is more a kind of a general culture, I think, across kind of sports broadcasting, that whenever I think of sports broadcasting, I still think of Andy Gray and Richard Keys and Do Me a Favour, Love. You know, that still rings in my mind, and I still think, oh God, you know, could I really ring up one of these? But yeah, I would find, I mean, I'm not sure I'd ring into a sports programme anyway, but the thought of it is slightly intimidating, I must admit, which is a shame, because I'm sure there are lots of people at TalkSport who would be very sad to hear that, I think. But
I think they would. But it's just a hard...
You know, it's a hard precipice to kind of to jump. But having said that, I think this goes back to our conversation earlier. You know, part of the reason why it's intimidating to ring in as a woman is because there are no others around. I mean, you know, if, like you say, with the exception of Georgie Bingham doing the breakfast show, which I probably would be more inclined to ring into, actually, because there is a female presenter. You know, the fact that you are faced with a wall of men is maybe that's what's driving the listening figures. Maybe, you know, I'm not saying I only listen to female voices, but I would be more inclined, I think, to listen more regularly. I do occasionally listen to TalkSport, but I would be more inclined to listen more regularly if there was more of a female input, and I don't see why there can't be. And that's the thing, maybe sort of broadcasting organisations like TalkSport, maybe they need to do the smashing of the ceiling, rather than saying, oh, but we're only reflecting, I'm not saying they are, but rather than sort of people saying, oh, they're only reflecting their audience. If their audience is 84% men, why should they not reflect that? I might argue that, in fact, their audience is driven by what they have on their station. And actually, maybe they could be very brave, and maybe it's up to them to put more female experts on air. And actually, I think that for all it gets criticised, and we were talking earlier about it gets stuck in this kind of political correctness loop, the BBC has done, I think, does more than anyone in terms of, because it, partly because it is a public service broadcaster, but it's you know, it's actively trying to put women in positions to have more female experts. And that they did a sort of a scheme a few years ago with encouraging female experts across all different different genres of news. You know, I think maybe I would love to see someone like TalkSport taking a punt and having more female experts on, and maybe that will then drive more female participation, which I think can only benefit everyone, because I think the more perspectives you have on a matter, I think the more you can be enlightened.
Yes, I think you're right. I think TalkSport probably are sort of aware of this, and I
can't imagine they wouldn't be, really.
And so. I'd hope over the next sort of year that they'll work to, you know, to change that in a more positive way, and I think that would only be a good thing. Punk's not dead! So goes the slogan. We're back with a view on that. We're all over that. Right after Bruce Hornsby. That's just the way it is. Some things will never change. Exactly 30 years old, though. If you look up the lyrics, you realise it could really have been written this week. Number 15 here, number one in America in 1986, Bruce Hornsby, The Way It Is. Now, Jules, you've had a busy week, I know, but where might you be appearing amongst us in this coming week?
Indeed, walking amongst the crowds. I will do Indie Wonderland on Wednesday evening from 8 until 10 p.m. on barricaderadio.com, doing usual tunes and chats. We had an American special this week. Who knows where we'll go next week? I haven't planned it yet, but yeah, we'll have our track of the month at the very least by a Hooton Tennis Club and various other tunes and chat. And then in terms of live appearances, Friday the 18th of November, I will be DJing at the Dragon Bar in Hastings in George Street as part of my DJ team, Sheila's Take a Bow. So that's it and all about it.
Excellent. Thanks to the cookie monster of podcasting, executive producer Rona.
Who I hope is wearing a moppy.
Jules, as we know, I try to make actually leaving the house something of a rarity.
Because it means that you have less chance of being accosted by Arsenal and Chelsea supporting members of the public.
Exactly. But when I do venture out, especially in the centre of London, I'll occasionally see a fellow or two, it's always men, of mature years meandering down Berwick Street looking for record stores that don't exist anymore. And they'll have badly coloured spiky hair and on the back of their leather jackets that don't quite fit anymore, in faded lettering where they once used up several bottles of Tippex, in the statement "Punk's not dead," usually with a missing apostrophe on the back of these jackets. Now, if I could be bothered with human interaction,
now isn't that a phrase that just sums everything up?
I'd say to them that punk was never alive in the first place. I'd say it was a smokescreen fanned by the efforts of Malcolm McLaren and the New Musical Express, and then exploited by formerly long-haired pub rock bands, badge sellers and T-shirt manufacturers. Now, as someone who wasn't even born until 7 years after the Clash sang No Beatles, Elvis or the Rolling Stones in 1977, do you have any affinity at all with this sort of punk rock ethos?
Well, the one thing that I've always taken from punk rock, and like you say, I've only consumed the history of it. I wasn't actually there. But the thing that I've always rather liked about punk rock, apart from the fact that there have been some stunning music produced. I mean, I know that there was a lot of cash in. So like there is with every musical sort of genre, musical kind of movement. Britpop was my kind of era. And yes, there were probably about five or six excellent bands and an awful lot of cash in bands. But some of the music that was produced, I mean, I had a cheery Saturday morning in the office a couple of weeks ago that was much improved by listening to London Calling from start to finish, and that really is a timeless album, I think. So there was some great music produced. The thing that I like about it, and you'll probably roll your eyes at this, but I do like the idea, the independence of spirit. And I know that you could argue, oh well, it was co-opted by major labels and it was just used by people like Malcolm McLaren to flog stuff, etc, t-shirts, badge sellers, but there was a kind of a DIY ethic about it that I do really like. And I like the idea that the sort of the style of the music was such, it wasn't exactly freeform jazz, was it? Kind of anyone could probably pick up a guitar and achieve something very quickly. And actually, as someone that plays in a band that leans a little bit towards punk, the idea that we could pop into a studio and have fairly simple songs and record six in a day and, you know, save up our money and do that ourselves was with the help of an engineer was great. And so, you know, I like the kind of the idea that it did feel a little bit like, well, to use the phrase that so many people are so fond of at the moment, taking back control. It felt a little bit like I like the idea that it kind of, I don't want to fall into reductive sticking it to the man, but I like the idea that, you know, that it gives you something that you can do yourself, really. And I like the independence of spirit of punk as something that, and also we'll go on to talk in a minute. I spent about a gig I went to this week. It's in a way punk is perhaps not the most emotionally nuanced thing ever, but there are times when, you know, one needs an outlet for one's anger and one's sort of severity of feeling, and punk is a very good outlet for that.
Yeah, maybe you can tell us, because this week you went to see a band that the Kent and Sussex Courier
that well-known punk epistle
describe who you went to see as a Tunbridge Wells punk band, and they're quite noisy, Jules.
Yes, that is one way of putting it. They're called Slaves. They're a duo. They are just they are terrific. They played they've always played locally. I where I live is probably about an hour from Tunbridge Wells driving. It's about 45 minutes on the train. So they've often played in small venues around Hastings and things. I'd never actually managed to see them when they were little. They played at Bexhill De La Warr Pavilion earlier this week. I went with a friend of mine. We stood in one of the side barriers. They were standing all in the main auditorium. Mm-hmm. And this is downstairs. Upstairs they were seating. Downstairs, the main auditorium, there was a middle bit where people stood. And then there were two kind of slightly raised balconies at the side that had standing on. And we stood on one of the side balconies and very much enjoyed the spectator sport of watching a number of quite young people. I'd say they were sort of later school years, A levels, possibly students in some university students in some cases, but all very young, I'd say. I saw a young band that I know locally who were about 18 or 19 that inevitably were all queuing up to go and see Slaves. And there was a real anger. I mean, this was a couple of days after the American presidential election, and I said to Lois, I wonder if they'll comment, because I can't imagine them being pro. And actually it was in a way a weird kind of joy to watch these kids getting this release really from this music. There was a large chant of F off Trump that was kind of going on between bands that lots of people enthusiastically joined in. There were quite a few of your punk survivors, a few older chaps. It did make us laugh. I said to Lois, isn't it funny that everybody under the age of 25 is dressed however it is that young people dress nowadays, and everybody over the age of 25, we were all stood there in our DMs and our Fred Perry's and our you know, and some leather jackets in some cases. We really did look like terrible throwbacks, but there was I mean, the music on the PA, they played some older punk as well, and there, like I say, there was a great kind of energy and a great sort of, you know, ferocity of spirit about it, and it was obviously a great release for lots of the kids downstairs, and that was really, you know, it was lovely. Also to note the sheer variety of things being thrown through the air. You could write a Michelin kind of guide on that, those spotters guides. It got kind of more and more wild as the evening went on. So it started with empty plastic glasses of beer, upgraded to full plastic glasses of beer at one point. Some glow sticks. Someone had clearly bought some glow sticks. They ended up against the bass drum of the drummer at one point. They were lobbed freely. Some clothes were thrown around. And then eventually some people were literally thrown through the air. It went beyond crowd surfing. I saw a young man actually be thrown and landed and got up and enthusiastically carried on. So presumably he was all right. But it was great fun, partly as a kind of a sociological outling, and partly also because they are a great band, and they have some real kind of I think the first album more than the second album. The second album is called Take Control and is trying to be a bit more overtly political, but their first album is a complete joy because it is very humorously amusing. They've got one that a rant about commuters that's called Cheer Up London, for example. So they had a real sort of twinkle about them. Stand up drummer, that's always good. The drummer sings.
That's always good, yes.
That was some kind of electronic element as well. They had a drum machine at one point, and they are the guitarist proudly introduced the drummer, who then picked up a bass as multi-instrumentalist. So that was quite entertaining. They didn't. We're going to finish the show with a song by the Slaves. They didn't. Ironically, they didn't actually do this one. I was hoping to be able to say, oh, and they did this, and it was brilliant, and it's my favourite. And they didn't do it at all. Which I suppose, in a way, is quite punk, isn't it? Although they did do an encore. But this is a fantastic, sort of a snotty tune. This is Slaves, and this is Feed the Manta Ray.
Talking to yourself on your knees on the floor. What will you do? What will you do? What will you do? Feed the man to it. 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 Until there's nothing left. Take what's best and leave the room. you're talking to yourself on your knees on the floor. What will you do? What will you do? What will you do? What will you do? What? So
you have been listening to a DACM Media production.